This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents A House in the Sky, a memoir by Amanda Lindhout and Sarah Corbett. Read by Amanda Lindhout.
In the burned house, I am eating breakfast. You understand, there is no house, there is no breakfast, yet here I am. Margaret Atwood, from Morning in the Burned House. Prologue. We named the houses they put us in. We stayed in some for months at a time. Other places it was a few days or a few hours. There was the bomb-making house, then the electric house. After that came the escape house, a squat concrete building where we'd sometimes hear gunfire outside our windows, and sometimes a mother singing nearby to her child, her voice low and sweet. After we escaped the escape house, we were moved somewhat frantically to the tacky house, into a bedroom with a flowery bedspread and a wooden dresser that held hairsprays and gels laid out in perfect rows, a place where, it was clear from the sound of the angry put-upon woman jabbering in the kitchen, we were not supposed to be. When they took us from house to house, it was anxiously and silently, and usually in the quietest hours of night. Riding in the back seat of a Suzuki station wagon, we sped over paved roads and swerved onto soft sandy tracks through the desert, past lonely-looking acacia trees and dark villages, never knowing where we were. We passed mosques and night markets strung with lights and men leading camels and groups of boisterous boys, some of them holding machine guns, clustered around bonfires along the side of the road. If anyone had tried to see us, we wouldn't have registered. We'd been made to wear scarves wrapped around our heads, cloaking our faces the same way our captors cloaked theirs, making it impossible to know who or what any of us were. The houses they picked for us were mostly deserted buildings in tucked-away villages, where all of us, Nigel, me, plus the 8 young men and 1 middle-aged captain who guarded us, would remain invisible. All of these places were set behind locked gates and surrounded by high walls made of concrete or corrugated metal. When we arrived at a new house, the captain fumbled with his set of keys. The boys, as we called them, rushed in with their guns and found rooms to shut us inside. Then they staked out their places to rest, to pray, to pee, to eat. Sometimes they went outside and wrestled with one another in the yard. There was Hassam, who was one of the market boys, and Jamal, who doused himself in cologne and mooned over the girl he planned to marry, and Abdullah, who just wanted to blow himself up. There was Yusuf and Yahya and young Muhammad. There was Adam, who made calls to my mother in Canada, scaring her with his threats, and old Muhammad, who handled the money, whom we nicknamed Donald Trump. There was the man we called Skids, who drove me out into the desert one night and watched impassively as another man held a serrated knife to my throat. And finally there was Romeo, who'd been accepted into graduate school in New York City but was first trying to make me his wife. 5 times a day we all folded ourselves over the floor to pray, each holding on to some secret ideal, some vision of paradise that seemed beyond our reach. I wondered sometimes whether it would have been easier if Nigel and I had not been in love once, if instead we'd been 2 strangers on a job. I knew the house he lived in, the bed he'd slept in, the face of his sister, his friends back home. I had a sense of what he longed for, which made me feel everything doubly. When the gunfire and mortar shelling between warring militias around us grew too thunderous, too close by, the boys loaded us back into the station wagon, made a few phone calls, and found another house. Some houses held ghost remnants of whatever family had occupied them. A child's toy left in a corner, an old cooking pot, a rolled-up musty carpet, There was the dark house, where the most terrible things happened, and the bush house, which seemed to be way out in the countryside, and the positive house, almost like a mansion, where just briefly things felt like they were getting better. At one point, we were moved to a second-floor apartment in the heart of a southern city, where we could hear cars honking and the muezzins calling people to prayer. We could smell goat meat roasting on a street vendor's spit. We listened to women chattering as they came and went from the shop right below us. Nigel, who had become bearded and gaunt, could look out the window of his room and see a sliver of the Indian Ocean, a faraway ribbon of aquamarine. The water's proximity, like that of the shoppers and the cars, both comforted and taunted. If we somehow managed to get away, it was unclear whether we'd find any help or simply get kidnapped all over again by someone who saw us the same way our captors did. Not just as enemies, but enemies worth money. We were part of a desperate, wheedling multinational transaction. We were part of a holy war. We were part of a larger problem. I made promises to myself about what to do if I got out. Take Mom on a trip. Do something good for other people. Make apologies. Find love. We were close and also out of reach, thicketed away from the world. It was here, finally, that I started to believe this story would be the one I'd never get to tell. That I would become an erasure. An eddy in a river pulled suddenly flat. I began to feel certain that, hidden inside Somalia, inside this unknowable and stricken place, we would never be found. Chapter 1. My World. When I was a girl, I trusted what I knew about the world. It wasn't ugly or dangerous. It was strange and absorbing and so pretty that you'd want to frame it. It came to me in photographs and under gold covers, in a pile of magazines, back-issue National Geographic bought for 25 cents a piece at a thrift store down the road. I kept them stacked on a nightstand next to my bunk bed. I reached for them when I needed them, when the apartment where we lived got too noisy. The world arrived in waves and flashes, as a silvery tide sweeping over a promenade in Havana or the glinting snowfields of Annapurna. The world was a tribe of pygmy archers in the Congo and the green geometry of Kyoto's tea gardens. It was a yellow-sailed catamaran in a choppy Arctic sea. I was 9 years old and living in a town called Sylvan Lake. The lake was 6 miles long, a Pleistocene gash in the vast brown prairie of Alberta, Canada, well north of the Calgary skyline, well south of the oil rigs scattered around Edmonton, 100 or so miles east of the Rocky Mountains, a solidly in-between place. In July and August, tourists came to float on the lake's calm surface and toss fishing lines from the docks of their cottages. There was a downtown marina next to a red-topped lighthouse and a small amusement park where vacationers bought tickets to ride down a giant, spiraling waterslide or run through a play maze made of brightly painted plywood. All summer long, the sounds of laughing kids and the buzz of motorboats floated through town. We were new to Sylvan Lake. My mother, having split from my father a few years earlier, had moved my two brothers and me there from Red Deer, the small city where we'd always lived, 15 minutes down the road. Russell, her boyfriend, had come with us, and so had his younger brother, Stevie. His uncles and cousins and other brothers and second cousins often dropped in on us for payday parties and ended up in our apartment for days, camped out in our living room. I remember their faces hoisted in sleep, their slim brown arms hanging from the sides of our chairs. My mother referred to Russell and his family as native, but around town people called them Indians. Our building was a white stucco fourplex with a pitched roof and dark wood balconies. The recessed windows of our basement apartment were small and narrow and let in next to no daylight. A green municipal dumpster sat in the gravel parking lot outside. My mother, a fan of all things bright and tropical, hung a teal shower curtain in our new bathroom and draped a brightly patterned spread over her bed. Out in the living room, she parked her exercise bike next to our old brown sofa. People always looked at my mother. She was tall and lean, with dramatic cheekbones and dark permed hair she kept fluffed up around the ears. She had limpid brown eyes that suggested a kind of vulnerability, the possibility that she might be easily talked in and out of things. 5 days a week, she put on a white dress with red piping and drove back to Red Deer to work a cash register at Food City. She returned with whole flats of generic brand juice boxes, bought with her discount, which we stashed in the freezer and ate after school using spoons. Sometimes she came home with a plastic tray of bakery leftovers, danishes and eclairs gone sticky after a day under glass. Other times she brought video rentals that we never returned. Russell worked only sometimes, signing on for a few weeks or occasionally a few months of contract work as a tree trimmer with an arbor company called High Tree, cutting limbs away from power lines along narrow roads. He was thin as a whippet and wore his dark hair long around his shoulders and feathered on the sides. When he wasn't working, he dressed in thin silk shirts in colors like purple and turquoise. Etched on his left forearm was a homemade tattoo, a blue-lined bird with broad wings, an eagle or a phoenix, maybe. Its outline had begun to fade, the bird's details washed into a pale blur on his skin, like something belonging on the body of a much older man. He was 21 to my mother's 32. We'd known Russell for years before he became my mom's boyfriend. Since the time he was 13, our families knit together by some combination of bad luck and Christian largess. He had been raised on the Sunchild First Nation Reserve. His father had disappeared early, his mother died in a car accident. My mother's parents, who lived about an hour's drive from the reserve, ran a Pentecostal summer camp for First Nations kids and ended up taking in Russell and his four younger brothers as foster children. My mother and her siblings were long gone at that point, and the native kids offered my grandparents a kind of second go-round at parenting. My grandfather was a welder, and my grandmother sold Tupperware, more Tupperware, in fact, than anybody in central Alberta, with regional sales records and a company minivan to prove it. For many years, they hauled Russell and the other boys along to church and prodded them through high school. They drove them to track meets and hockey games and to weaving classes at the Native Friendship Center. When the boys brawled, my grandmother sighed and told them to go on outside and get it all out. She forgave them when they stole money from her. She forgave them when they cussed her out. The boys grew into teenagers and then into young men. One made it to college. The rest ended up somewhere between the reserve and Red Deer. What nobody banked on, what Jesus himself might never have foretold, is that somewhere along the way, coming home to her parents' farmhouse for visits and holiday meals, my mother, with her three little kids and imploding marriage to my father, would fall for Russell. She called him Russ. She did his laundry for him. She liked to kiss him in public. Every so often, he bought her roses. Early in my childhood, I'd thought of him like a sideways cousin, but now Russell, having moved directly from my grandparents' house into mine, was something different, a hybrid of kid and grown-up, of kin and interloper. He did kickboxing moves in our living room and ate potato chips on the couch. Once in a while, he bought stuffed animals for me and my little brother, Nathaniel. A funny little family was what my grandmother called us. My older brother Mark put it differently. A fucked-up little family, was what he said. I'd been to the Sunchild Reserve a couple of times to visit Russell's relatives, always over the protests of my father, who thought the place was dangerous, but no longer had any say. Russell's cousins lived in low-slung tract homes built along dirt roads. During our visits, we ate bannock, a sweet, chewy fry bread, and ran around with kids who never went to school and drank cans of beer out of brown paper bags. Every house, as I remember it, had walls cratered with fist holes. I recognized the shape because Russell sometimes did that to the drywall at our house. My mother's life with Russell might have been viewed as a kind of screw you directed at all the white kids she went to high school with in Red Deer, most of whom still lived around town. My mother had left home at 16 and gotten pregnant with Mark at 20. Russell gave her an odd new cachet. He was young and mildly handsome, and came from a place that people considered wild and unusual, if also dirty and poor. My mother wore beaded earrings and drove around town in a little white hatchback car, a feathered dream catcher fluttering from her rearview mirror. There was also the fact that my father, her early 20s sweetheart, the man holding her babies in the delivery room photos, had recently announced that he was gay. A fit young man with a big smile and a neatly trimmed beard named Perry had moved into my dad's house. When we visited, Perry took us swimming at the rec center pool, while my father, who had never cooked in his life, made us bachelor-style dinners. He rolled luncheon meat, ham into cylinders speared with toothpicks and surrounded them with a few pieces of cheese and celery, adding a piece of bread on the side. He laid our plates on the table, all four food groups duly represented. My father had begun building his new life. He hosted dinner parties with Perry and enrolled in college to become a rehab practitioner and work with mentally disabled people. My mother, meanwhile, worked on her own resurrection. She read self-help books and watched Oprah reruns on cable. In the evenings, Russell poured rye whiskey from a big bottle into a tall plastic cup. My mother sat with her feet resting in his lap on our sofa in front of the TV. More than once, he pointed at the screen, at the moment's hot cop or tidy-haired young dad. He'd say, "You think that guy's good-looking, don't you, Lori?" It was a flicker we all recognized. "I'll bet," Russell would continue slowly, his eyes on my mother, "you wish you were with someone like that." A pause. The TV man's face would seem, in an instant, to melt and reshape itself into something more aggressive and leering. "Right, Lori? That's what you're thinking?" My mother responded gently. He'd broken some of her bones before. He'd hurt her badly enough to keep her in the hospital for days. As the rest of us stared hard at the television and the air in the room grew electric, she'd reach for Russell's arm and squeeze. "No, baby," she'd say. "Not even a little." Mark was 13 and on the brink of a lot of things. He had a scraggly mullet, blue eyes, and a washed-out denim jacket he rarely removed. He was a solitary kid, given to roaming, the devoted owner of a slingshot made of hard plastic. Nathaniel, meanwhile, was 6 years old and had a cyst on his lower right eyelid, giving him a baleful look. My mom and Russell doted on him, calling him Bud and Little Buddy. At night, he slept in the bunk beneath mine, clutching a stuffed rabbit. It was Mark I followed around, trailing him like a dinghy behind a boat. "Check this out," he said one day after school as we stood in front of the green dumpster outside our apartment building. This was several weeks after we'd moved to Sylvan Lake, a warm afternoon in early fall. I was in fourth grade, and Mark had just started middle school. Neither one of us had many friends. The kids in our new town instantly had read us as poor and uninteresting. Mark planted his hands on the lip of the dumpster and boosted himself upward, heaving a leg over and dropping inside. Seconds later, his head bobbed up again, his face flushed, his hand wrapped around an empty Labatt bottle. He waved it at me. "Come on, Amanda," he said. "There's money in here." Our dumpster served as an open-mouthed repository for the whole neighborhood's trash, collected by a town truck every Wednesday. It became my brother's version of a country club swimming pool. The interior, even on the crispest days of October, was soft and damp like an old leaf pile, smelling like sour milk. The two of us slid between mounded bags, their skins greased by leaked liquids and loose trash, our voices ringing tightly off the walls. Mark ripped into sealed garbage bags, pitching cans and bottles out onto the grassy strip in front of the apartment, rooting up lost quarters, old lipsticks, pill bottles, and magic markers, most of which he stuffed into his back pocket or tossed in my direction. Once he held up a fuzzy pink sweater, just my size, and gave a little shrug of outrage. "Geez, what's wrong with people?" We loaded the empties into plastic shopping bags and, smelling like old food and malt, carried them to the bottle depot in town. 20 cans equaled a dollar. One Food City bag usually held 15 cans. One bag times 15 cans times 5 cents equals 75 cents. $1.50 for 2 bags, $3 for 4. And then the sum total divided in 2, half for Mark and half for me. No fourth grade math lesson could compare. The real money lay in what we called 60s or 60 pounders, terms gleaned from Russell, the hefty 60-ounce liquor bottles that got us an easy $2 from the bottle depot man. These were our gold. Over time, Mark and I began to travel, a few blocks north and south of our street, over to the cul-de-sacs where single families lived in bungalows instead of apartments, visiting 5 or 6 dumpsters regularly. Better real estate, for the most part, meant better garbage. You'd be surprised at what people throw away, even poor people. You might find a doll with a missing arm or a perfectly good videotape of a perfectly good movie. I remember finding an emptied-out wallet, brown leather with a delicate gold clasp. Another time I found a pristine white handkerchief with smiling cartoon characters embroidered on it. I kept them both for years, the handkerchief folded up neatly inside the wallet, a reminder of all that was pretty and still to be found. I almost always blew my bottle money in one place, at a thrift store down by the lake. The store was underlit and arranged like a rabbit's warren, selling old clothes, porcelain knick-knacks, and the literary detritus of summertime tourists, fat Tom Clancy thrillers and everything by Danielle Steele. The National Geographics were kept on a shelf in a far corner, their yellow spines facing outward and neatly aligned. Lured by what I saw on the covers, I took home whatever I could afford. I snapped up the mossy temples at Angkor and skeletons brushed free of volcanic ash on Vesuvius. When the magazine asked, "Are the Swiss forests in peril?" I was pretty sure I needed to know. This was not to say that I didn't, in equal measure, rummage through the Archie comics sold new in a different corner of the store, studying Veronica's clingy clothes and Betty's pert ponytail, the sultry millionaire's daughter versus the sweet, earnest go-getter. Theirs was a language I was only just starting to understand. I kept the Archies in a drawer but put the National Geographics on a table in my bedroom. By Thanksgiving, I had accumulated probably 2 dozen. Sometimes I would fan them out like I had seen on the coffee tables at the homes of some of the fancier kids from my old school. My Uncle Tony, my father's brother and the richest person in our family, was a subscriber. At night, in my top bunk in Sylvan Lake, I went through the magazines page by page, feeling awe for what they suggested about the world. There were Hungarian cowboys and Austrian nuns and Parisian women spraying their hair before going out for the night. In China, a nomad woman churned yak yogurt into yak butter. In Jordan, Palestinian kids lived in tents the color of potatoes. And somewhere in the Balkan Mountains, there was a bear who danced with a gypsy. The world sucked the dankness out of the carpet in our basement apartment. It de-iced the walkway outside, lifted the lead out of the sky over the plains. When at school, a girl named Erica called across the hallway that I was a dirty kid, I shrugged like it didn't matter. My plan was to move on, far away from my school and street and from girls named Erica. One evening, just before I started 5th grade, Carrie Crowfoot and I went walking around town. Carrie was a beautiful Blackfoot girl, a year older than I was, and one of my few friends. She had long black hair and almond-shaped eyes and eyelashes that stuck straight out. She was related to Russell somehow and had moved with her mother and brothers from the Sunchild Reservation to Sylvan Lake. She lived in a house a few doors down from the thrift store and never went to school. At 10 years old and with no money, Carrie still managed to work a brassy kind of glamour. She sassed the patronizing shopkeeper who sold us 5-cent pieces of gum and bragged to me about the various kids she'd beaten up when she lived at the reserve. When she came to my house, she didn't give a second glance to our ratty furniture or Russell's stray cousins lounging boozily in our chairs. I liked that she'd pronounced the dinner of crushed dry Ichiban noodles I'd served her amazing, that she'd recently enlightened me about what a blowjob was. We wandered along Lakeshore Drive, heading toward the amusement park. A cool wind had picked up over the water. It was early September. Tourist season was pretty well over. The sidewalks were empty. A few cars hurtled past. Carrie complained often about how dull Sylvan Lake was, saying she wanted to move back to Sunchild. She was jealous that I got to stay with my dad in Red Deer on weekends. I might have told her it was nothing to envy, but the truth was I counted down the days. My father's house had plush carpeting and thick walls. I had my own bedroom with a brown ruffled bedspread and a cassette player with New Kids on the Block tapes, and a collection of new paperbacks, entire sets of the Babysitter's Club and Sweet Valley Twins series. I said nothing about any of it to Carrie. At the marina, rows of powerboats floated in their dock slips. The amusement park lay dormant. The fiberglass water slide stood drained for the night, skeletal against a pink sky. "You ever seen what's in there?" Carrie asked, kicking a foot against a shuttered ticket kiosk. I shook my head. Before long, she'd found a way to pull herself up from the top of a garbage bin to straddle the high wall of the crazy maze, which zigzagged like a cattle fence around one edge of the park. Abruptly, she disappeared behind it. I heard sneakers hit pavement and then a laugh. I was a frightened kid almost all of the time. I was scared of the dark, and I was scared of strangers, and I was scared of breaking bones and also of going to doctors. I was scared of the police, who sometimes came to our house when Russell's crew got noisy huffing glue in our living room. I was afraid of heights. I was afraid of making decisions. I didn't like dogs. I was supremely afraid of being laughed at. In this moment, I had a feeling about what would happen next. Not wanting Carrie to make fun of me, I would scramble up the wall, get dizzy, fall down, break some bones. The police would come, strangers, all of them, and they would bring their dogs. Naturally, this would all happen in the dark, and then I'd have to go to the doctor. Which was why I almost turned on my heel and ran. But the way home was dark now, too, and I could hear Carrie calling from inside the maze. I heaved myself up onto the garbage can and boosted myself to the top of the wall. Then I jumped. As I landed, Carrie took off running. In the dim light, her hair seemed to glint blue. The interior walls had been painted with bright amateur renderings of clowns and cowboys and silly monsters, whatever would amp up the joy and light terror of summertime kids running free. Carrie Crowfoot and I would be friends only another 6 months. Her mother would move the family back to the Sunchild Reserve sometime that spring. Before that, I'd start to get more interested in the kids I met at school and in school itself, getting chosen for an enrichment group for advanced students. Carrie would remain an outlier, uninterested in school and seemingly not required to go. A few years later, when I was finishing middle school, I would hear from my grandmother that Carrie had a baby. I wouldn't know much more about how things went for her because eventually, my family would purge all of them from our lives. Russell and Carrie and most everyone we knew during this time. Inside the maze that night, though, she was impossible not to follow. We were fast, corkscrewing around corners, screeching to a stop when we hit an abrupt dead end. When I think back on it, I imagine we might have squealed as we ran, heady with the moment's disorientation. The truth is, we were serious and silent, but for the sound of our thwapping sneakers and the rustling of our jackets. Carrie's hair floated behind her as she charged ahead, sidewinding through the alleyways, caught up in the split-second decision-making about which way to go next. Finally, though, we allowed ourselves to relax and feel giddy, forgetting that it was dark and we were trespassing, forgetting everything that scared or haunted us, lost in the playland we'd never before seen. High Tree, Russell's Arbor Company, was having a big holiday party at a restaurant in Red Deer. My mother had been thinking about it for weeks. After her shifts at the supermarket, she'd go looking at dresses in the Parkland Mall, flicking through the sale racks. At home, she announced she was on a diet. We put up a Christmas tree in one corner of the living room, a raggedy pine that my mother had picked up from the parking lot sale at Food City. She went to the Christmas Bureau in Red Deer, signed a paper attesting to the fact that she had 3 kids and made $7 per hour, and picked up gifts for free. They'd been collected and wrapped by volunteers, embellished with colorful curling ribbons. I knew which two of the presents beneath the tree were for me because they were both labeled girl, age 9. A few days before the party, my mother got a new perm. She'd found a dress, which was hanging in her bedroom closet. It was black and shimmery, and already I'd spent a lot of time touching it. Now it was Friday night. Russell had showered and put on a pair of black pants and a collared shirt buttoned neatly up to his neck. He poured some rye and sat on the couch, pulling a squirming Nathaniel onto his lap. Stevie, Russell's 17-year-old brother, was babysitting. We were waiting for my mother. The blow dryer hummed from the bedroom. Mark and Stevie clicked cassettes in and out of our boombox, fast-forwarding to the songs they liked, while I did math homework on the floor. Nathaniel, holding his stuffed bear, had drifted over to the TV and pressed his face close against the screen, trying to hear over the noise. Russell poured a second drink and then a third. He hooked one leg over the other and began good-naturedly to sing, "Lori, Lori." When she walked down the hallway, we all turned to look. Her black dress was short in the front and long in the back, cascading in a pile of ruffles that brushed the floor. Her thin legs flashed as she walked. She wore new shoes. As if following a script, Russell rose to his feet. My mother's cheeks looked flushed, her eyes bright, her lips painted red. Her pale skin looked creamy against the black dress, which was so tight and shiny it seemed shellacked onto her body. We kids held our breath, waiting to hear what Russell would say. "Fucking A," was what he said. "You look awesome." True enough, my mother looked like a movie star. She smiled and held a hand out to Russell. She kissed our cheeks to say goodnight. We were cheering, as I remember it, literally shouting with excitement about the grand time they would have. Russell put down his cup, found my mother's dress-up coat, an ill-fitting mink number she'd inherited from my great-grandmother, and then he whirled her out the door. That night we watched movies from our video collection. We watched Three Men and a Baby, and then the new Batman. I made popcorn in the popper and passed it out in bowls. Somewhere in Red Deer, my mother was dancing with Russell. I imagined a ballroom scene with glittering pendant lights and wide-mouthed glasses of champagne. I dipped in and out of sleep until it was late, and I woke up with a jolt. The TV screen was dark, the apartment silent. I woke Nathaniel from his spot on the floor and guided him to the room we shared, nudging his sleeping body onto the bed. I climbed up into my bunk, a trace of holiday sparkle still lit in my head, and went to sleep for real. There was a surreal quality to what came next. There always was, if only because these things, when they happened, almost always happened in the middle of the night. My mother's shouting would tunnel into my sleeping mind, gradually stripping the scenery out of my dreams until there was no more clinging to unconsciousness and I was fully awake. Something crashed in our living room. There was a shriek, then a grunt. I knew these sounds. She was fighting back. Sometimes I'd see scratch marks on his neck in the morning. The words were streaming out of Russell, high-pitched, hysterical, something about cutting out her eyeballs, something about blood on the floor, so much of it that nobody would know who she was. "You cunt," I heard him say. Then a big thud, also recognizable. The sofa being flipped. I heard her run from the kitchen to the living room and down the hallway. I heard her panting outside our door before he caught her and threw her against it. I could hear him breathing too, both of them seeming to gasp. In the bunk below me, Nathaniel started to cry. "Are you scared?" I whispered, staring at the dark ceiling. It was an unfair question. He was 6 years old. We had tried before to stop it. We had dashed out of our rooms and started yelling, only to have the two of them, their eyes dark and wild, run to their bedroom and slam the door. If my mother wanted our help, she wouldn't show it. Sometimes I'd hear Stevie in the hallway saying, "Hey, cool it," to his brother. "Come on, Russ." But he, too, grew meek in the face of their fury. Eventually, a neighbor would call the police. A few times, my mother had gone to the women's shelter in Red Deer. She'd made promises to my grandmother and grandfather that she'd leave Russell, but before long they'd be back together. At the women's shelter, there were shiny linoleum floors, lots of kids, and heaps of good toys to play with. I remember my father looking crushed when he came there to pick us up. The holiday party fight wound down pretty quickly, my mother and Russell stalking back into each other's arms, my popcorn strewn across the living room, the couch frame broken, a fresh hole in the wall. I knew how these things went. The next morning, Russell would weep and apologize to all of us. For a few weeks, he'd be repentant. He'd sit in the living room with his head down and talk to God, looping through the language we knew from our grandparents' church. "Dear Lord, our Savior, in your name, blessed be your Son, please save me from Satan, yours is the way, and in Jesus Christ, thank you and amen." In the evenings, he'd make a big show of going to AA meetings. My mother, for those weeks, would have more power. She'd order Russell around, telling him to pick up his clothes and run the vacuum cleaner. But the needle on some unseen inner gauge would start to quiver and creep back toward red. The contrition would slip away. My mother would blithely go out one afternoon to get her hair cut and come back, by Russell's estimation, late. He'd be waiting on the couch, his voice a flipped blade. "What took you so long, Lori?" And, "Who were you meeting all hoard up like that?" I'd watch my mother blanch as it dawned on her that the jig was up, that before long, maybe tonight, maybe 3 weeks from now, he'd go nuts on her again. I couldn't profess to understand it. I never would. I just tried to move past it. By the time the lights were off and all the bodies had settled, I was gone, launched. My mind swept from beneath the bed sheets, up the stairs, and far away, out over the silky deserts and foaming seawaters of my National Geographic collection, through forests full of green-eyed night creatures and temples high on hills. I was picturing orchids, urchins, manatees, chimps. I saw Saudi girls on a swing set and cells bubbling under a microscope, each one its own waiting miracle. I saw pandas, lemurs, loons. I saw Sistine angels and Maasai warriors. My world, I was pretty certain, was elsewhere. Chapter 2. The Drink. When I was 19 years old, I moved to Calgary. For any kid from central Alberta, Calgary is the big city, a beacon of possibility ringed by busy highways, its glass towers rising up from the plains like a forest. It's also an oil town, a boom-and-bust headquarters for stock traders and energy executives working to extract and sell the huge reserves of oil sitting beneath the soil. I arrived in 2000 when times were especially good. Oil prices were on their way to doubling, and before the year was out, they'd triple. Calgary was flush with wealth and new construction. Glitzy restaurants and shops were opening at a frenetic pace. My boyfriend Jamie moved with me. He was a year older than I was and had grown up on a farm south of Red Deer. We'd been dating for about 8 months. Dark-eyed and brown-haired, he was handsome in a Johnny Depp way, with narrow shoulders and strong hands that helped make him an excellent carpenter. The two of us liked to trawl through thrift shops, putting together outfits we thought of as edgy. Jamie dressed in cowboy shirts with cloudy mother-of-pearl buttons. I wore anything that was sequined, along with the biggest earrings I could find. He could play any instrument, from the harmonica to the bongos to the violin. He strummed love songs on his guitar. He worked construction jobs when he needed money, but otherwise spent whole days drawing pictures or playing music. I was totally smitten. I thought that in Calgary, Jamie could record a CD, maybe get some sort of a deal. For me, too, the city would be a new platform, though for what, I wasn't exactly sure. We found a one-bedroom apartment in a dirty downtown high-rise. Our bed was a mattress on the floor. Jamie painted the bathroom walls yellow. I hung pictures and sat houseplants on the windowsill. My life felt instantly urban, adult. But the city was expensive. I got a job working at a clothing store, a different branch of a national chain that I'd worked for in Red Deer during high school. Jamie found work washing dishes at Joey Tomatoes, a trendy restaurant in the Eau Claire Market, while looking for a job in construction. Between the two of us, we could barely make rent. On a bitingly cold afternoon not long after we arrived in Calgary, I put on my winter coat, a vintage brown leather jacket with an enormous fur collar, and went out walking with a pile of resumes tucked in a manila folder. I wanted to try my luck as a waitress. I'd never worked in a restaurant, but when I saw the girls who worked at Joey Tomatoes, I was both jealous and awed. They glided around in high heels. Jamie told me they made a lot of money. The first place I walked into, mostly because I was cold, was a nice-looking Japanese restaurant with a glossy black sushi bar and hanging lamps styled to look like lanterns. It was the post-lunch lull. Techno music pulsed quietly over the stereo while a couple of strikingly beautiful waitresses set tables for dinner. In a far corner, about 6 men were having some sort of lunch meeting, papers spread out in front of them on a table. I sheepishly handed my resume to the willowy Japanese hostess and stammered a few words about having just moved to the city. I thanked her and turned toward the door. It was clear I would not fit in. "Hey, wait a second," somebody called. One of the men from the corner table followed me to the entry. He looked to be in his late 20s, with dark hair, chiseled cheekbones, and a sharp jawline, not unlike a comic book superhero. Are you looking for a job? He said.
Yes, I said.
Done, he said. You got one. This was Rob Swiderski, the manager of a nightclub called The Drink, located a few blocks from the Japanese place and owned by the same restaurateur. He was offering me a job as a cocktail waitress. I felt vaguely conflicted. I was flattered. I had heard about The Drink from friends in Red Deer who sometimes came to the city to party and had said it was trendy and expensive. But I wanted to serve meals, not drinks. Somehow that seemed more respectable. When I said no, Rob laughed. If you're looking for a job, you're looking to make money, right? He said. Just give it 1 week. One shift, even. If you hate it, you quit. I walked back into the cold, having agreed to show up the following evening. He had never even asked for my resume. The Drink took up the corner of a city block, with a restaurant and 5 separate bar areas, offering 40 different kinds of martinis. Chandeliers hung, lit like constellations, from the high ceilings. A hardwood dance floor occupied the center of the space, with a short stairway leading to a velvet-roped VIP area. About 20 waitresses worked at a time, all of them pretty. They wore high heels and designer dresses and carried little round drink trays coated with rubber to avoid spills. A few introduced themselves, but most hardly looked in my direction. I'd soon learn that new girls came and went all the time, some too flaky to keep drink orders straight, and others not managing to pull off the right image for the club, which, as Rob reminded everyone at weekly staff meetings, was classy sexy. If you looked cheap, you got sent home. Under Rob's management, The Drink had become the hottest club in town, hosting an after-work happy hour for corporate Calgary, which morphed into a more glamorous and freewheeling late-night pickup scene. This was where NHL players gathered after their games, touring rock stars came after their concerts, and oil barons showed off their money. On weekends, the line to get in was 5 people wide and stretched around the block. Working from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. on my first night, wearing high heels, dangly gold earrings, and the nicest dress I owned, I was given a tray and some instructions on ordering drinks and printing up bills. I was then assigned a quiet section at the back of the club. For the next few hours, I shuttled chilled martinis and tumblers of rye between the bar and 4 or 5 tables, where the customers, most of them businessmen, thanked me politely and handed me their credit cards. At the end of the evening, a waitress named Kate showed me how to use the computer to cash out my tips. I had made $50 in 4 hours in addition to my wages and was overjoyed. Though Jamie, who had no interest in bars, had been angry when I told him I'd taken a job as a cocktail waitress, I thought now he might at least recognize that money was money and this money was good. "How do you do?" said Kate, looking over my shoulder. Catching sight of my total, she winced. "Oh," she said, "that's brutal." I had no idea what she was talking about. By my standards, I got rich working at The Drink. Showing up for my second shift, I was again handed a dead section at the back of the club, but before long, a group of garrulous stockbrokers showed up and started ordering $300 bottles of Cristal. I went home a few hours later with $500 in tips. Over the course of a few months, I worked my way up to handling bigger sections and busier nights. I bought nice shoes and elegant cocktail dresses. On a good night, I could make $700. On an exceptional night, I made $1,000. I kept rolls of cash stuffed in a jar in our kitchen cupboard until there was so much of it that I started stashing bills in the freezer. When another waitress told me that freezers were the first place burglars looked for cash, I got better about making deposits in the bank. I made friends with the other girls, learning how to deftly dodge drunken propositions, how to milk a good tip with some attentiveness and a smile. I was drawn to Priscilla, a legendary high earner at The Drink, who used her tip money to take long exotic vacations. When I first met her, she'd just returned from Thailand, which seemed to me unimaginably far away. Priscilla showed me how to maintain a pack of regulars, good customers who would be sure to buy their drinks from you, by giving them VIP treatment, plopping reserved signs on their tables, and serving their drinks not in the usual plastic cups, but in glasses fetched from the bar upstairs. For a while, I just enjoyed the freedom that came with having money. I quit my retail job. Jamie had been picking up day labor on the city's many construction sites, though more and more, he stayed home to be with me during my off hours, Sometimes he played a short set at an open mic night in a cafe near our apartment, always to enthusiastic applause. He'd stopped minding that I worked at the drink, but he never came to see me there. I'd cook us an early dinner and spend almost an hour in front of the mirror while Jamie sat in the other room reading a book or playing music. For me, getting ready for work was like getting ready to go on stage. I had a closet full of black dresses, a bucket's worth of makeup. The whole act was easy by now. You put on your highest heels, trussed up your hair, painted your eyes and lips. Your job was not to be pretty, but to be stunning, and in a way that made men want you and other women jealous, even if it was just flirty play-acting. Some of the girls at the drink had cashed in a few months' worth of tips and gotten boob jobs as a professional investment. I opted for an old waitress trick I'd learned in the changing room at the drink, layering a push-up bra over a padded bra, which made me feel a little like I had an iron bar strapped to my chest, but nonetheless served its purpose. After work, while some of my friends from the drink were going to after-hours clubs, I was heading home to curl myself around Jamie as he slept. He and I had settled into a quiet routine. In the mornings, we went for meandering walks along the Bow River. When he wasn't working, we went out for expensive lunches. I found a used bookstore called the Wee Book Inn near our apartment and bought piles of paperbacks to read. For the first time in my life, I had real money in the bank, enough to fund a year at college. I'd just turned 19. I knew I was supposed to want a stack of textbooks and some sort of high-minded career plan, but that didn't interest me. I figured going to university would only put me in lockstep with all the 20-somethings in suits who coursed down our street in the mornings headed to their skyscraper jobs, resurfacing at the drink 10 hours later, acting as if they were 50 years old, flopping into the leather barrel chairs saying, "Jesus, what a shitty day. I'll have a gimlet straight up." Back at home, my mother's latest boyfriend, a cruel man named Eddie with whom she'd been living in Red Deer, had been sent to jail for racketeering. My brothers and I agreed this was a relief. She had dumped Russell back when I was 12, but she still gravitated toward unstable men. As a result, I'd spent most of my high school years living with my dad and Perry in a house they'd bought in Sylvan Lake. Mark had moved in with friends, while Nathaniel had stayed on with our mother. We all loved her, but we worried any time a man got close. My mother was in her early 40s. Her dark hair not yet showing any gray. After Eddie left, I took the bus from Calgary every few weeks to have dinner with her. She'd moved into a sweet little house in Red Deer and found a good job with the Catholic Social Services Agency as an aide in a group home for troubled teens. She'd been reading self-help books, trying to teach herself to meditate. She spoke about saving her money to travel. Her talk was filled with the language of fresh starts. I used to joke with Jamie that my childhood seemed tailor-made for the Jerry Springer show, not just an episode, more like a whole season. My mom had a thing for bad men. My dad was one of the few openly gay people in town. My grandparents prayed fervently to Jesus, speaking in tongues when the occasion called for it. My brother struggled with drugs. I, too, had issues. I often starved myself to stay thin, obsessively counting calories. I cut my food into halves and quarters and then ate half of that. After going days without a real meal, I'd snap and binge, eating everything in sight before forcing myself to vomit. This, too, was right out of the dysfunctional family handbook. Still, we tried. The year Eddie was sent to jail, my father called my mother and tentatively invited her to come to Christmas. They'd softened toward each other, my parents, over years of forced communication about school schedules and which child needed new shoes. Also, Perry and my father were as settled and married-like as the next couple, more so than my mother had ever been with any of her men. Slowly, she'd come to appreciate this. Christmas morning, Mom walked through Dad and Perry's door with its tinseled wreath and velvety red bow, smiling at me and my brothers, apologizing all over the place that she hadn't been able to afford gifts. What she'd brought was a painstakingly written batch of letters, printed on pages of computer stationery with colorful Christmas lights around the borders. One for each of us in the room, including Dad and Perry. I opened my letter and read it slowly. In it, she described a few of her best memories, clear and happy moments like the two of us horsing around in front of the mirror in that basement apartment in Sylvan Lake, fluffing up our hair. She spelled out her love for me and her hopes that I would always have good luck and great adventures. I don't know what she put in the other letters. All I know is that every one of us was silent and a little teary. After that, we spent every Christmas together. We would never be a close family, exactly, but we loved one another in a certain fierce way. Chapter 3. Going Somewhere. "Jamie," I said, "let's go somewhere." We'd brought a blanket down to the river one late summer evening, about 9 months after moving to Calgary. I was tired and antsy. I'd been studying the travel ads in the Sunday paper, the $800 round-the-world flights, the grainy pictures of palm trees in faraway places, the package deals and flights to cities whose names I'd never heard. Jamie was on his back, watching the summer clouds slide through the sky. I admired the simple arc of his nose, the smoothness of his skin, the honey brown of his eyes. He was imperturbable, a puzzle to me sometimes. His ability to loiter in record stores and thrift shops, to pass time without purpose or go weeks without working, made me impatient. "Where do you want to go?" he said. "Anywhere," I told him. "I mean it, anywhere. Let's just plan something, go somewhere." Here was what I loved about Jamie. The slow-breaking smile, the long-fingered hand that clamped affectionately onto my shoulder. "Let's do it," he said. "Anywhere is good." The next day I was at the Wee Book Inn, digging through old issues of National Geographic. Where I wanted to go really was Africa, but that hardly felt like a beginner trip. The only place I'd ever been outside of Canada was Disneyland as a kid, once with my dad and once with my mom. Jamie had never left Canada. I tugged out a thick plank of magazines, slid to the floor, and started shopping for a destination. Jerusalem? Tibet? Berlin? The funny thing about National Geographic was it told the same sort of elemental story every time, featuring whatever was lost or unexplored, mystical or wild. "You're here," the magazine seemed to say, and we're there. It was not meant to be a taunt, more like a small flag planted on behalf of the stay-at-homers. Having the magazine was a gesture of respect for the world's outer limits, its predators and prey. "I see that it's all there," it enabled you to say. "And now, thank you, I'll stay put." For me, it was also a provocation. There was a cover article on Bolivia and the Medidi, a small national park in the upper basin of the Amazon, where parrots flash through the mahogany trees. In another story, I found photos of white mist waterfalls slicing into the forests of Paraguay. I unearthed an old issue I'd had as a kid, with a story about a slab-like magical plateau somewhere in Venezuela called Roraima, covered in quartz crystals and drifting above the clouds. The names alone seemed delicious and made up. They ran through my mind like poetry as I walked home, erasing the blunt syllables of the place I lived, the places I came from. Medidi, Venezuela, Paraguay. The decision about where to go seemed straightforward. No city, no country, no coast in particular. Just a continent. South America. There was a place called the Adventure Travel Company a few blocks from the drink, where two women sat behind computers, encircled by a mini coliseum of glossy resort brochures and racks. The cheapest plane tickets we could get from Calgary were to Caracas, the capital of Venezuela. It was now early September 2001. I reserved two seats for a trip in January, with return flights 6 months later, paid in cash. It was done, happening. The trip became our organizing principle. This was how Jamie and I started our sentences. When we go on our trip, when the trip gets closer. At the secondhand bookstore, I bought a Lonely Planet guide to South America, thick as a Bible, 5 years old, and already thumbed over. Jamie and I went through it, page by page. We imagined ourselves pushing through tangled jungles, communing with the Mayans on our way to summiting snowy peaks beneath a blinding sun. We read the guidebook section on insects and snakes and flesh-eating flies that tunnel into your legs and pythons that dangle from trees, and we let that unsettle us. We read the section called Dangers and Annoyances that said we could be pickpocketed or mugged or conned into handing over all our money to an orphanage that wasn't really an orphanage. We read the warnings about malaria and flimflam artists and highway bandits. We allowed our parents to heap on their concerns about car accidents and fatal fevers. We imagined the worst, or what, in our innocence, we thought of as the worst, because that seemed to be some necessary part of our preparation, owning up to the inherent gamble. By the time Jamie and I left for South America on a frigid morning in January 2002, the world's dangers were more overtly on display. Thousands of people had died on September 11th. There had been anthrax scares and false alarms and people talking on television about a jihadist underworld and an axis of evil. Just before Christmas, a terrorist had boarded a plane in Paris and tried unsuccessfully to ignite his shoe. In Pakistan, a few weeks later, a Wall Street Journal reporter named Daniel Pearl set off to do an interview connected to the shoe bomber's financing. He was kidnapped and later beheaded. When it came to danger, the totally unreal had, in the span of a few months, become entirely feasible. Despite it all, we were going. Our plan was to drift from Venezuela into Brazil and then to Paraguay. Sitting on the tarmac in Calgary as our plane was de-iced, I tried to push away any thoughts of death and disaster. South America was not the Middle East, I told myself. It was not America, even. We'd compressed and rolled and shoved our belongings until they were dense as bricks, making room for what we saw as necessities, extra bottles of mosquito spray and sunblock, laundry soap, antifungal spray for our shoes, plus a giant squeeze bottle of ketchup and the salt and pepper packages we'd been collecting from fast food restaurants for months. When I visited my grandmother before leaving, she donated a hefty jug of antibacterial gel and some Tupperware, all of which I'd improbably managed to fit into my pack. By way of goodbye, she offered a cheery and quick double disapproval of my travel plans and my everyday fondness for short skirts and high heels. I hope you know you won't be able to go down there and wear those, you know, model clothes you like to wear, she said as I planted a kiss on her cheek. From his recliner in their living room, with its old piano and Grandma Jean's collection of ceramic purple roses, my grandfather added, I hope you know if you get yourself into trouble, we won't have any money to get you out. I let this comment float right past. Chapter 4. A Small Truth Affirmed. Caracas late at night looked only a little like the jungle city I'd been imagining. Our cab driver spoke English and pointed out landmarks. Most of the buildings were shuttered for the night. I could see big palm trees, their fronds pinwheeling heavily over the broad boulevards. The city looked sedate, leafy, exotic. This might have been a moment to tuck myself under the crook of Jamie's arm or kiss his palm and say something about how alive I felt, having traversed this impossible-seeming curve of earth with him in one day, beginning in the numbing cold of Canada and ending in the drippy heat of another hemisphere. But I didn't do any of that. It wasn't that sort of moment. Some part of me was scared by what we'd done. The next morning, we woke in a 3-star hotel room, which our travel agent had booked in advance and was more expensive than any other place we'd stay. I drew back the curtains and got my first glimpse of the waking city. A massive Pepsi billboard sat outside our window. There were skyscrapers in the distance and jets flying overhead. On the street, several floors below, people sat in their cars staring blankly ahead as they waited for the stoplight to turn. It was oddly, depressingly familiar. There were no donkey carts, no parrots, no panpipers, or charming old women wearing ruffled blouses and lace on their heads. Only the air felt foreign, thick and a little mossy. I pushed open the window and peered down. On the sidewalk, several brown-faced men in baseball caps were selling fruit out of wooden crates, piles of stacked oranges, peaches, papayas, and several things I didn't recognize. Jamie, come see this, I said. Looking over my shoulder, he said, should we go buy some? Jamie was always hungry. I was remembering what the guidebook said about fruit and vegetables, how everything had to be scrubbed and peeled. I was afraid of bacteria at that point, the same way I was afraid of terrorists and bandits and being alone. I was planning to eat nothing but thoroughly cooked rice and beans all the way through South America and to do a lot of hand washing. Beyond that, we had our ketchup. Let's